Welcome to the I Know Strange People podcast. I'm Jeffrey Morabito. Today I have Mary De Vicentes on. She is a painter that I have admired for some time. Normally, when I pick someone to interview for this podcast, there's something about the work that makes me think, that makes me wonder, that makes me question something about the work, the artist, and even myself. I spend some time looking at the work beforehand, researching some of the biography, and then doing my best to forget all this right beforehand. I think doing this interview with Mary, I was asking myself, or maybe re-examining, why I had these questions and curiosities about her work. Her paintings I find to be very powerful, and they make me think, I guess, also a little bit about myself, which is what all good art should do. There's a lot of mystery to it. And there's a lot of mystery about why I am drawn towards certain types of work. This is my interview with Mary De Vicentes. Okay. I think I'm ready now.
Excellent.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. It's a beautiful day out.
I know. It feels like a normal summer in Brooklyn. The streets smell like marijuana.
And things are starting to bloom.
Yeah. It's so about like a year ago, I was, like everyone else, very nervous for the obvious reasons. But I also get allergies.
Oh, yeah.
So it's happening a little bit to me also today. I was like, uh-oh, do I have it? But then I remembered, no, it's just the allergies.
Yes, thank God.
Yeah. So it's been quite some time since I've seen or talked to you, or actually most other people.
That's right.
Are you surviving, I guess? Like, that's the obvious question.
I have survived. I am surviving. And yeah, I think all considering, I've done pretty well. I think this is probably the hardest time in a way, because it's gone on so long and the stress level has been high all this time. So I think I'm not the only person feeling a little bit of burnout.
Yes, I was talking to one of my studio neighbors earlier today about the same thing, and how the last, I think the 1 year mark kind of really hit me like a sledgehammer.
Yes.
And, but I know your work can be kind of stressful, right?
Well, that's part of it. I was lucky because I could continue my day job as a psychotherapist, from doing it remotely. So that's great. And I really appreciate that. But also, all of my clients are much more stressed out than usual. So there's been kind of a secondary kind of impact on me from that as well.
Right. So, of course, I'm going to get ahead of myself. So we're going to have to loop back afterwards. But the first thing that comes to my mind about, because I have had quite a few friends that are therapists that are also artists. And that's not a question I want to get to why that happens. But also, I can say, like, just with anybody from strangers to good friends of mine, especially people I talk to quite often and know a lot about them, they really influence my work. Do you think your patients influence your work directly or indirectly? Well, I'm sure to a certain degree you can't say not indirectly, because we don't know those things.
Right. I think they must on many levels. Just the fact that my work involves narrative and storytelling, and people come to tell their stories, that definitely is something that impacts me. And sometimes there is a moment in a story that someone is telling me about their life that may inspire some part of something that I paint, for sure.
Right. It's so to prepare to talk with you today, I listened to a couple podcasts and read a couple interviews all about, I guess, dreams. I have to say, regardless if I was talking to you or not, I think I researched that material anyhow. So
yes, dreams are really very fruitful.
They, it's funny because it's, I would say in the past, I would look at my dreams and think to myself, like, I guess maybe they would like maybe scare me sometimes, how intense it can be, how real it can be, how, odd it can be. And these days, usually like all the things I just mentioned, instead of scaring me, I just kind of find it humorous.
The content of your dreams, you mean, or?
Oh, it's just like the shockingness of how fucked up they are.
Yeah.
Like, for example, maybe like, I don't know, like 20 years ago, I would probably like wake up and like, oh my God, like what the fuck is wrong with me? And now I'd pretty much say the same thing and just, while laughing at myself. Like,
exactly. Our dreams are primary process, so we don't have any control over their content, really, unless we've learned how to do lucid dreaming, which is a whole different kettle of fish.
Well, so I have to get this, like, the elephant out of the room and tell you about a dream I had recently, which... Excellent. I found very, I've like researched a lot of my dreams before, and this one I've not found an answer to it. But I just found this very hysterical because it was so just odd. Where I forgot the beginning of the dream, but I remember I think I was trying to buy something like cigarettes or alcohol, and a person at the register tried to card me, and I didn't have my ID for some reason. By the way, I did buy cigarettes when I was 15 often, so happens to the best of us.
For sure.
And so the register, the lady at the register, including myself, was a little bit frustrated. So she said, okay, just give me your hand. And I gave her my hand. And then she put in my hand this like handful of salt. And that was one of the moments in the dream where I realized it's a dream, because I spent some time like looking at my hand, looking at this pile of salt. And I was like, what's wrong with you? Like, what am I supposed to do with this salt? And then I was like, wait a minute, this is a dream. And then I woke up. Anyway, you don't have to give your, any feedback about that. I just kind of, I guess I wanted to like illustrate the point, how I feel like, at one point in time, that would kind of scare me. Like,
right.
What's wrong with me? What does this mean? Does this do with a relationship or something? And now I guess I kind of just accept that maybe I can't really understand myself, and that's okay.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess what I like about dreams is that, you know, the way I look at dreams actually is that it's a gestalt way of looking at it, which is that you are every character in your dream.
Right.
You are the salt, you are the shopkeeper, and you are the person receiving the salt in your palm. And I like that because it's like, talks about different parts of us and different, you know, different ideas and different parts of us that might be in conflict, or part of you that's being kind of judgmental of yourself, and part of you that wants to get the cigarettes, and I don't know what the salt is. That would be interesting to, you have to pre-associate to that.
I did the research on it, and apparently it has a lot of meaning for Christians. But I was not really raised religious at all. My parents are both very Catholic, but on Sundays was when football was on, so that was more important. So I really, right.
The salt, it was Lot's wife, right? There was something about salt there, I think, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I forget the whole story, but I know there's salt involved somewhere.
There's some, there's a couple, I should probably read the Bible rather than just draw my knowledge of the Bible from movies, but there's a couple salt scenes in one or two Jesus films.
That's right. Yes. Probably more than one.
Right. So I read that you first got into psychotherapy from your mother when she was a art therapist for prisoners.
Close. My mother was an artist. She went to art school. But you know, this was back in the day. You know, back in the 50s housewife era.
Right.
So she, you know, when she had kids, she stopped. She didn't really pursue a career, let's put it that way, although she did finish a four-year art college. But then when I was about, I guess, 8 or 9, I guess she was really bored. And she had been painting herself along the way. But she went to work in our state hospital for the quote, insane. That's what it was called at the time, believe it or not. So, I would go with her. And she would teach art to the people who lived there. And at that point, people didn't cycle in out of institutions. They stayed for years. So they might be fully functional and have ground, permission to go off the grounds, but they just came back there at night, you know.
I was very influenced
by their work, actually.
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
I was very influenced by seeing their work. It was one of my first real exposures to other people's work for the patients.
Huh. Right. I always had a mixed opinion about looking at, because if you go to, for example, I think maybe 2 years ago, there was an exhibition at the Drawing Center. I may be wrong about it. Maybe it's not the Drawing Center. So hopefully I'm not putting shade on someplace incorrectly, but I think it was of, the work of, prisoners.
Oh yeah. Oh, right. Did see that. I don't know where I did see a show up that, but I'm not sure where it was. Yeah.
And I think in the past I was interested in looking at books in the library, like very when I was much younger, maybe my teenage years, of people that were essentially criminally insane and the artwork that they made. And something about the, I guess the reviews about it, or the text for the show, made me think, made me feel a little bit like, I don't know, a little bit icky about being interested in that show, just because I felt like people were like looking into the suffering of other people and trying to, I don't know, intentionally or not, like, it kind of like felt like it was like mental illness porn, the way I...
Voyeuristic, is that what you mean in a sense?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of outside art these days. And I guess it's also just part of the trend where sometimes it bothers me, where it's like, it just doesn't feel very, it just doesn't feel very good, I guess.
Right. Well, of course, I was 9 or 10, so that was not my experience. I was just hanging out with these folks while they painted.
Oh, right. Yeah, no.
What they were doing, because they were, in school you learned how to color within the lines. That's what you learned in elementary school, is how to color in the, coloring book lines. So it was really nice to see some freedom involved in people's work and their own unique subject matter, which you wouldn't typically see elsewhere.
Mm, right, right. Oh, I was definitely, I would say, very interested in that type of work before. So I was very much into the surrealist.
Yeah.
And I only mentioned that just because it feels like, I guess it's, I don't know, this is like the time period where everything is being re-examined, a lot of old previous interests. And it's something that I guess since you said you had an interest very early on, and it sounds like it still influences your work.
Probably because it was such an early experience, you know.
Right.
It was sort of like permission to be able to paint whatever was coming through your own, your particular psyche. I remember looking at a painting by Goya of Saturn eating his son and thinking, wow, I could paint about anything. It doesn't have to be about flowers I was watching my mother paint nudes and flowers, you know?
Right.
So nice thought, another kind of whole way of conceiving what art could be, to think, wow, I could paint about all these other things that are much more personal.
I think that, at least for myself, and maybe, I don't know if this applies to you or perhaps other people, looking at the art of people that are not so mentally fit, it gives me for some reason permission to let myself go more so. And that's something which I don't really know why I would need to get the permission to let myself go like that.
Yeah, well, because they're thinking outside the box, and there's something kind of wonderful about that. They're not thinking about where it fits into culture or society or trends, and that's a wonderful freedom to have, because we all get kind of, especially if we go to art school and grad school, and we start to learn that there's a right and a wrong way to paint, and it can be very constricting.
Right. It's, I guess it's would you say it's a bit of a romantic view to think about how these people, they have some inhibitions, or they have some constrictions in their normal life. I guess in the case of prisoners, like literally, but for other people, some other inhibitions, restrictions that allows them to become more free when they're given the chance to.
Possibly. I mean, there's also, I think, probably like any other artist, they're trying to work through something. Mm. They're trying to literally work through something that they're living through or thinking about or feeling.
Hmm.
You know, I don't think that's just from being an outsider artist. I think we're all doing that as artists, pretty much. Even if our work is very abstract, we're still grappling with something.
Do you find yourself trying to work through many different things or one type of thing? I feel like this is a bit of a rhetorical question where there is no answer for that. But...
Well,
a lot of questions I think I'm interested to ask you is questions I also ask myself. So,
of course, yeah. I mean, I think I have some kind of primary themes, and you know, I might veer off them on occasion, but they're pretty much driving most of my work, you know.
Right. There's so a long time ago, before I was trying to professionally pursue being an artist, I was really into playing music. I had a band, I would write songs.
I remember you telling me.
And the reason why I bring that up now is because the paintings that I remember the most well that you've done, it doesn't necessarily remind me of, let's say, any of my own paintings, but it would actually remind me of some of my own lyrics from songs about years ago.
Ah, that's interesting.
For some reason, I used to write a lot about spiders or flies and webs. And
that's wild. Well, you know, it's interesting because my work is informed by the written or spoken word. And often I am inspired by lyrics.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah.
In what way?
Well, it turns out that my brain processes best through, not through visual, but through words, through narrative, through poems, through phrases. And this might be because I discovered about 10 years ago that I have something called aphantasia, which is the inability to see an internal image. So if you ask me to picture my son's face, I can describe it to you in words, but if I close my eyes and I try to picture it, it's a complete blank. Now, some people can see internally better than others, and there's a range, but I can't. I mean, literally, it's nothing. So actually, when I, you know, I'm inspired by, let's say, a lyric, and there's a phrase that really, really just strikes me emotionally, and I want to paint about it. I think, well, how would I ever paint this? And then I, you know, draw kind of a very quick sketch, and then I make the sketch into a painting. It's as if that's my way of finding an image that I can't find inside my own head. So it's through the kind of the left, almost the left brain. I mean, it's not that simple. It's not left and right brain anymore, but that part of the brain that is, I guess, sequential, not spatial, but sequential, you know, word based, that's my way in.
Huh. That's interesting. I wonder how much do I have that myself?
I know, right? I mean, I'm sure we all have it some, but, you know, I used to try to do Tibetan Buddhist meditations where they, you know, they say picture Tara and picture three of her arms and she's got a tiara on and she's got this kind of expression and her one foot is doing. And I would I could see maybe imagine one arm or something. That was as far as it would go. And I'm like, this is not the meditation for me.
Wow. So I have this, a couple people, I have this, this argument or difference of opinions about listening to music while I paint.
Yeah.
Some people like to insist that, there's this school of thought that you're not really painting if you're listening to music at the same time. Personally, of course, I think that's a little bullshit. I think that's about people's own connection to music. Some people, I can say since I'm older now, a lot of my friends that used to love to listen to music when we were much younger, 20 years ago or so, they don't listen to that much music anymore. That happens with most people. That happens to myself also. But I also think, but I still love music as much as I always have. And I think one stereotypical story with listening to music while painting is a lot of times I'm listening to something and the album is finished. And I think, oh, I'm going to put this album on next. Once I finish this brush stroke or this part of the painting, and if I'm really into it, next thing I know it, 2 or 3 hours has passed before the next album comes on.
Right.
So I still don't think that proves or goes against that you're not really into painting if you're listening to music at the same time. It's just a device for departure.
Yeah, I think it can be helpful or not helpful depending on, you know, any given day or any given moment and how you're, where you are with the painting and with yourself. But, you know, some of the best people have some of the best ideas when their ego inhibiting thoughts are turned down. And I would think that music could kind of turn down those thoughts so that you could be a little bit freer in your work.
Hmm.
You know.
Do you listen to music while painting?
I do pretty much what you were just saying. I'll listen to it, and then if it goes off for some reason or I'm finished, whatever, sometimes I'll just keep painting and I won't even think about whether there's music or not. But generally, it's helpful to me because it does help kind of get me into a rhythm.
Right.
And I get a little bit less self-conscious. And so it's helpful. I mean, I know some people were like, no, that I would be too self, I would be too free. You know, they didn't, no, that's not for them.
Yes.
But for me, I think it's more help than harm.
Hmm. And do you have any preferences, or are you very selective about the type of music you listen to pair it up with what you're painting, or is it just depends how you feel that morning?
No, really. Actually, I just put on my iPhone playlist and press shuffle. And that's that. Whatever comes up. You know, sometimes I get annoyed by something and I'll go, you know, next. But other than that.
Right. Yeah, I've realized actually, and this wasn't the case a while back ago, but the last couple of years, sometimes I can't listen to music while painting that has lyrics.
I could get that. Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes it's very, very inspirational.
I think
the oldest music that I've consistently listened to that I find as inspirational now as it used to be would be someone like Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, he's great.
But that's hard to, that doesn't really say anything because, well, most people like Leonard Cohen.
It's hard not to.
Yeah. Do you think anything about the way you paint or how you work now has changed this past year?
Let me think. Well, I think there's been some external structure put on my work because I've been working at home and not in my larger studio in the city. So I have been working small in a very consistent way, whereas maybe last year I make something small and I make something large and then I make, you know, more varied. And so I've had the opportunity to make a long series of small works, which I think I've learned from quite a bit. And I think I've had more patience, more concentration, ironically. There's less external stimulus, more likely to be, you know, I wasn't going out anywhere except for the park. I think that's the other thing that affected me was the place I did go was, you know, Prospect Park, because I live across the street from it. So I think nature wound its way more into my work in those small pieces in this last year.
I have been noticing perhaps more trees in your work.
More trees. That was something that was happening already.
Right.
Definitely it's continued.
Yeah. Is there do you think maybe the work has pretty much stayed the same, just the format has changed?
It's really hard for me to step back and know how much it's changed because, I approach every individual painting as if it were an individual. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whatever it is I'm trying to paint sort of speaks to me in terms of how to approach it. So I don't really think so much in where my work is developing toward. It feels like each painting has its own development.
Right.
I sometimes worry if that's not a problem, but people tell me there is consistency between, you know, they can tell what I've, you know, they can tell who did the work that I do, you know, it's by me. So that's good. But so I think it's hard for me to kind of see a trajectory in that way.
I think I've had the same thoughts about my own work also.
Yeah.
I like to see every individual piece as its own journey.
Exactly. I mean, that just seems to be something that the way I paint, that I really can't do much about.
Right. For better or for worse, we are who we are.
Exactly. You know, I mean, there's things you can't do. Like, for instance, I've been working on a series where I decided to limit my palette. And, you know, of course, that brings out different things than you would be doing if you hadn't limited your palette. It brings out more possibility of patterns and textures and tone. So that's always, you know, that's always a growth step, I think. And it's also a way to have some consistency if you want that.
I know you like to think of your work in terms of allegories for things. And I think at times, I sometimes look at my own work as certain things, as allegories also. But I've been thinking more what I used to consider allegories. I begin to think of it more in terms as tropes. And just because there's something about a allegory, how it exists outside of a painting versus inside of a painting. And I guess also you mentioned about the ego before, about how that can be very inhibits you from giving you the freedom you want to what you want to paint sometimes. Where am I going with this line of questioning? I just feel that because I see there is actually, I don't know necessarily repetition in your work, but I guess you can maybe say the symbols that you use.
That's true. Yeah.
And is this something that you've consciously done or just maybe more noticed afterwards and just leaned into it?
A little bit of both. I think, you know, I do think we all have kind of internal consistency, whether we know it or not. You know, we're drawn to certain things, like I'm drawn to a certain, you know, depiction of trees based on personal history. And so it repeats itself in my work. But then at a certain point, you think, well, that's part of my vocabulary. And it's nice to have a vocabulary. Doesn't mean you have to get stuck with it, but it's nice to have kind of a language to work with. Maybe that is where there is some consistency in my work, which is that there's a, you know, certain characters, whether they're parts of nature or lone figures within a landscape or, you know, other things, they do become part of my visual language, which I think is helpful.
When did you think you arrived at who you are as a painter? Because right now, for me, when I see one of your paintings, I think, that's a Mary de Vicentes. It's not, I mean, yes, you can call it a style, but I actually kind of dislike that word style.
Yeah.
It's something I feel like has more to deal with how people brand work these days than what the work is about. But it has your fingerprints and it has certain types of a familiar narrative quality.
Yeah.
But I also know that doesn't happen overnight.
Right. Well, you know, I have a kind of a interesting trajectory around that because when I went to art school, I was initially a observational painter, painting, you know, directly from nature or portraiture or figures, whatever, you know, just traditional art school kind of,
right.
You know, plein air, etc.
Were you a plein air painter?
Yeah, exactly. But that lasted about 2 years. And then a lot happened in my family. There was my nuclear family pretty much was gone. They died and my sister had a breakdown. So I basically lost my family in the middle of my art school years. So my work started to reflect this kind of huge, huge thing that was happening in my life. And I remember my teacher at the time, his name was Raoul Middleman. He said, you're such a good painter, but now this other thing is cropping into your work. You know, you've got ideas, you know, you got ideas in your work now. And you know, it's not as good, he said. I was like, okay. But he said, but you know, you got to go there. What are you going to do? So I thought, okay, I'm going to take a break from painting and I'm going to become a printmaker and I'll work with these ideas in black and white. And I'll see you know, what that can do for me would kind of simplify it. This is where I am, you know? So I spent the last 2 years of art school doing lithography. And then I went to London to study more printmaking at St. Martin's. Mm. And immediately I got really, really turned off by trying to make color lithos because you had to make each color separately. And
oh, wow.
Laborious and really, really boring. And then this one teacher said, I'll show you how to make a monotype. And it was just really rolling a color on a plate and painting into the background color as if it were painting. And then putting a piece of paper on top and transferring the image onto the paper. And for me, it was perfect because it was like it took away the illustrative tightness that I had been stuck on when I was trying to make my work more idea-driven.
Right.
And it brought this freedom to my work. And it was like, oh, my God. And I just realized I could, this is when I realized, going back to my childhood, that I could paint about anything. And it could be coming from my head. It didn't have to come from observation. So for really, for 30, I want to say 30 years, I did exclusively monotypes.
Hmm. And that makes sense.
In doing them, I learned how to paint.
Huh. Well, your work has a very fresh feeling to it. So.
Right. Because with monotypes, at least the way I was doing them, you had about an hour and change to finish the, you know, the print before you, you know, you transferred it before it was too dry. So you learned how to work very immediately.
By the way, you are not the only art student that was told in a very almost derogatory way that when you have ideas, that's not necessarily the best thing in the world.
Exactly. Well, I do think that I did take a hit because I was trying to, you know, paint from my head instead of from what I was seeing. And I didn't know how to do that yet, really. So
I think right. You just, yeah, my God, I can make a whole different podcast about all the stories I can relate with that.
But that, you know, that explains, you know, how. So then I was really only, I was looking back, it's only been, I want to say seven. I kind of inched back into painting in the last 20 years, but really just, you know, doing all, I wasn't really doing straight on oil painting or painting acrylics straight on till maybe 7 or 8 years ago. So it's not that, you know, I haven't been back to painting all that long, but I think I just brought my history of monotyping and it kind of gave me a head start because I knew what I wanted to paint about.
Right.
Yeah.
That's, so I mean, that's first thing of all, that's very tragic to hear about your family when you're younger. But it does kind of make me think about the idea of catharsis in art, though. And I know I heard once someone say that you don't have to have a horrible childhood to make good art, but it doesn't hurt.
It's probably true.
So what's your thoughts on the idea of catharsis in work and making art?
Catharsis is a mean of kind of working through something personal in your work. Is that what you mean? Or what do you mean by catharsis?
I guess I mean by catharsis is getting some sort of, yes, you can say working through something, but it's also the idea of trying to resolve something.
Resolve, yeah. I don't think anything actually gets resolved.
Hmm.
You find a different relationship to it. So I don't know that I believe exactly in catharsis, but I do think that I think if you read about the lives of even the most abstract of painters, you would find there's a deeply personal connection to what it is that they're painting. I don't think you can get away from it.
Right. I think for me, I feel that the idea of catharsis in the work is, the goal of catharsis, I think, is maybe the impetus where you kind of have no choice but to create.
Yes.
With that said, that to actually get the catharsis, to get resolution, for me, that's very Sisyphean, where you still want it, but...
Yeah. I mean, back to some of the folks who lived in the state hospital, they often had repetitive imagery in their work that was highly repetitive. And it is as if they were trying to work through some essential issue in their work. And maybe not. I mean, there was one guy that I'll never forget named Mr. Lamont. And things were different back then. I mean, my mom used to have, Mr. Lamont had ground privileges, so he could be at the hospital. And my mother used to have him come over and help paint our apart, you know, our house. And once we took him to our Philadelphia Art Museum with us. So he was, you know, kind of on the periphery of our lives in a certain way, but he would paint these kind of realistic figures and landscape scenes. And then he would gray them out. He would gray every painting out. So it's like reverse Grisal. He would just do the reverse. The gray would be on top of the colors. And, you know, it's no coincidence that he'd had a lobotomy. And, you know, when you have a lobotomy, it means that you've, you know, there's a lot of emotional lability that gets lost. So there's a flatness to your affect. And it felt to me like he was painting that over and over again.
Huh. That's very interesting.
I never forgot that. It's really powerful.
Right. Yeah. It's, I mean, I think my, my opinion about looking at the art of people that had, mental issues changed when I was younger, is something I could research and look it up in books. But then I actually met people and were friends with people that were definitely mentally ill. Sometimes self-diagnosed, sometimes in and out of hospitals, sometimes everyone knew it and they had to go in and out of like prison, and which was kind of crazy because, well, I mean, the crazy part's literally that the person was crazy, not they couldn't help themselves.
That's the tragedy of our system now is that most people with mental health issues end up in prison.
Right. So it kind of, I don't know, it gave me a different outlook at looking at the artwork by people with problems like that. It's, because it's kind of, I guess it's like, I can talk about certain friends of mine, some more closer, some more distant, but people that have those types of issues. And something about the idea of, I guess, contemporary art and what the curator does with them, I actually find problematic at times because for me, I guess...
element. That's what happens when the market gets involved.
Right. Yes. Yeah, there's a...
Yes, that's a whole different thing.
There's the there's this one curator I know, Karen Wilkin, Horace used to tell me. There's art, and then there's the art world. And they might have some things in common, but those two things don't have anything to do with each other.
Well, it certainly feels that way sometimes.
Right. But with that said, you exhibit often, or I've seen you exhibit quite a few times. You're still exhibiting now, I guess, maybe online. So you have something up now. Mm-hmm. How do you reconcile that, the idea of what the difference between actually, you know, I guess you can say the art worlds, or personally, I like to view it, I like to categorize it or compartmentalize it as the art that exists in the studio and the art that exists outside the studio. Like within, so like, I guess, how do you reconcile the difference between the two?
Well, Well, for me, I think it's been important to find representatives for my work in terms of it being in the world, who I feel comfortable with and whose values I share. And, you know, that's, I think, the way I've done it. I think that's kind of hard to come by, but you know, I don't know what would happen if my work was suddenly super in demand and I had to kind of figure out who to work with and who not to work with and all those kind of questions that come up when you're like, all of a sudden, like, oh my God, that's a whole different kettle of fish.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of, well, it's, so I don't know whether or not to say this or even if I believe in this, I inherently have certain, I guess you can say Buddhist ideas in my mind also, just mm-hmm. because I'm part Chinese and it's nothing about the religion. It's almost cultural. Sure. And the ego, I think, comes big into how I paint, because for me, it's the ego is kind of the enemy.
Oh, yeah.
Where well, it's we need one. Excuse me?
We need one, but we don't want it to be the boss.
Well, it's funny because it's the most important thing outside the studio and the most terrible thing in the studio for me.
Right. You do need it outside the studio and inside. Well, I guess the way I, in terms of, since I've also studied Buddhism, and it's kind of an important philosophy for me, I try to think about my work, you know, when I get caught up in ideas of success or someone doing better than I'm doing or wanting something more or blah, blah, blah. I just kind of settle back into that this is what I do because I, you know, we all say this, that this is what I do because I have to do it. It's really important to me. I'd be doing it whatever was happening with it. But I just sort of see it as kind of, you know, it's not so different than my therapy work. It's what I offered the world. It's my skill. I offer it. Yes, I get paid, but I don't make a fortune. I try to be fair. And I feel the same about my artwork. It's something that I offer. And that sort of gets the ego out of it a little bit in terms of, you know, how well it does or how well it doesn't do or, you know, what its fate is or trajectory. Right. Is. And it just helps, you know, sometimes I have to remind myself, like, oh, yeah, you're doing this because remember, you know, and then you calm back down again. So I think that's how I deal with it.
Yeah, it's, well, I think it's, there's something about, it's a little bit odd about being an artist where you go through these also because of the art world and just how things work, you get these unusual boosts in your ego when you have an opening and everyone mm-hmm. wants to talk to you and mm-hmm. you have a million emails and messages. And then afterwards, the drop off where no one knows your name anymore. It's so like it feels like it's also I don't know. It seems a little bit masochistic, or the fact that we do this to ourselves, to our egos, to make it like a roller coaster ride.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't really feel like I'm on too much on the ride. I don't feel that so much. Like when I'm an opening, I'm kind of in a zone. I'm not thinking about who's coming to talk to me. I'm just responding. You know, I don't really, it doesn't do much for me. My ego, it just doesn't do much for me. You know, I mean, it's nice. It's nice to have community in that way. And it's nice to be part of a conversation. But I don't have a big crash really because I don't feel like I got that high. You know, there's something about it that doesn't boost me up, shall we say.
Right. No, I can see that from yourself. I think the first conversation I had with you was at one of your openings, and I was like, oh, this person's talking like a normal person. That's odd.
Well, that's the only way it's fun to talk.
Right.
Otherwise, it's like, oh, I hate small talk. I mean, I like to talk, but I like it to be real, you know, because it's not fun.
Right. I mean, normally for myself, I sometimes get a little bit too at those social type of events, not all the time, but sometimes I get a little bit anxious. And
who doesn't?
Right. And it's not that I can't carry myself about in those types of events. Basically, I'm just reminding myself the whole time, don't say something too cynical. Don't say something.
Well, when I first started, found Bushwick, and I started going to the openings there, and I didn't know anybody really in the beginning. I mean, you know, I gravitated toward Michael David's gallery, but I mean, it was a huge scene at the time, and I would just go to an opening, and I would literally just make myself the goal of just standing there and not leaving. I said, you don't have to talk to anybody, Mary. Just stand there 20 minutes and then you can go. And, you know, over time you just get more comfortable, and somebody says something to you, or, you know, you get a little more comfortable when you say something to somebody, and then you start to get to know people. And
right. Yeah. I thought it was kind of, it was the Bushwick art scene is kind of interesting, where it's, you have a lot of, I guess, acceptance of characters.
Totally. Different ages, different everybody. It's pretty open, different kinds of work.
Right. Yeah, it's, I guess you can say I miss it to a certain degree. It's kind of odd, though. I guess the idea of a community as an artist is something that I've had to think more so about.
Mm. Yes.
It's something that I, it's just how I am. I need something that I like to complain about.
Well, I was really delighted to find the Bushwick community was really the closest thing I had to a community in many years. So it's been very, very impactful for me.
Have you been able to, what have you been doing to keep connected to other people this past year, other artists?
I have a Zoom call with a couple artists every week, which is nice. And I also decided to participate in Michael David's online salon series called the Yellow Chair Salon.
Right.
Which is kind of a, you know, discussing work, and then he has guest artists come in to help discuss your work. That's been, I think, a way to stay connected, really. And I mean, people are joining. That's not just Bushwick people. That's people from all over the country, actually, and beyond, you know. So, right. But it is a way to stay in contact during this time.
I have sat in that chair before. I'm surprised it's still standing.
Exactly. Love that chair.
It's been making me think a lot recently about what it is to, to have a community in the art world.
Because
I guess you make up, I always look at the art world in terms of like the Olympic symbol, where you have all the interlacing circles.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know,
one
circle is good, and with every successive circle, it begets terms into something else.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's other parts of the city where if I go to an opening, I don't feel quite as at home, but I might know a few people.
Right. Sometimes I, for myself, I can say what helped me, I guess, break out of my shell as an artist is from all the time I spent living overseas, where I couldn't, every place I lived in, for the most part, I learned, I at least had a little bit conversational in terms of the local language, or became much more fluent the longer I spent. But it was such an impediment to not speak a language and go to an opening.
Oh, yeah.
So something about whenever I found an English speaker just became much more easier.
For sure. Yeah, that's exactly. So you think that would translate to being here, it would be easier because everybody's speaking the same language.
Yes, but I have to say one of the first exhibitions I participated in, like literally the first year that I came back to the States, because I was living overseas for like almost 10 years, actually well, over 10 years. I got invited to some sort of a weird art fair in Midtown. And then I showed up with my paintings and not a single person spoke English. They were all speaking Russian.
Oh my.
Yeah. And I was like, well, I guess they look like they're wealthy. And if it's good enough for the president, it's good enough for me. But but with that said, that's the nice thing about New York. You can find some circles where people do speak different languages.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just one art world here, it's many.
Right. So what are you working on currently?
I'm working on some mid-size work here at home. I haven't really transitioned back to my studio yet. That is, as I mentioned, it's I reduced my palette to red, black, and white primarily. And I've gone back to a theme that I had when I was making monotypes, sort of loosely based on, what do you call it? Well, they're euphemisms, words, phrases that are kind of very image laden and action driven. They have to do with death. Death. Oh. Death, rebirth. I've thought of it now that it's not really death. It's sort of a transition from one state to another. So it's kind of a broader kind of an interpretation than it was when I made my monotypes. So I just finished one called Giving Up a Ghost. It's not giving up the ghost. It's giving up a ghost.
A ghost. Okay.
So, and actually, it is really actually about giving, sort of like surrendering the imagery would suggest that one is surrendering the unnecessary part of the ego.
So the ghost is maybe, it's part of the reason why the ego exists.
The ghost is the ego, in a sense. The ghost is the, you know, the sense of self that we think defines all of us. When it only defines, it's more like a computer program or a process.
Wow. Okay, so I'm going to make another leap, a little connection here about... I remember I was a professor or maybe a guest speaker at a school I went to a while ago, another artist whose name I cannot think of, but would remember right after the interview is over. But she said that everyone makes paintings for someone. And maybe it's for an old teacher of yours. Maybe it's for a previous lover or a friend, or maybe it's simply someone like your parents. And it made me think about all the time, especially since I've spent a lot of years teaching, do I paint for someone? Like, is there some audience member that never gets to see it that I'm doing it unconsciously? So I guess that's how I relate to what you said about giving up the ghost.
Giving up who you're painting for.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's really, that is part of the whole story, isn't it? Because we have our personal stories, our personal narrative that is part of our, you know, identity.
Right.
Including the characters in our story. Here comes the fire engines. I'm on Prospect Park West, so.
Yeah, it's
and my windows are closed.
Wow, that's I guess you'd have to have a specific type of music to go along with that.
Yeah, really.
Well, when I was in Bushwick, they at one point in time, I got back into a lot of industrial music, which I haven't listened to for a long time, but that jackhammer outside had to be drowned out somehow. So,
that probably was the only thing that could work.
Right. Yeah. It's a good thing I kept all my skinny puppy. Okay. That's, it's the whole idea of like a painting for ghosts. It's something that's always entertained me. And you know, there's the Philip Guston quote about ghosts.
What is that?
He says that when you first start painting, let me see if I can, you know, I am going to slaughter this quote. And I have...
Google it, right?
Right. Because I just... it's interesting what I think of Philip Guston. Well, what do you think of Philip Guston?
Oh, I like Philip Guston. I like his courage in shifting into his personal narrative, you know, into his representational work. I mean, it took courage at the time.
Yeah, I think he's very, well, these days he's very topical.
Of course, yeah.
He's probably become even more famous when they canceled his retrospective.
Yeah.
But it's also, I guess you can say he's a hero because the art world turned its back on Philip Guston when he went into imagery.
Right.
So there's a certain type of respect and admiration with someone that has, the courage to make images like that, whatever the images may be. But for him, it was political.
Yeah, given that time, you know.
Okay. I found the quote. The name of the quote is a section of his book. I think it's called Studio Ghosts. When you're in the studio painting, there are a lot of people in there with you. Your teachers, friends, painters from history, critics. And one by one, if you're really painting, they walk out. And if you're really painting, you walk out.
That's great. Yeah. I do remember that quote now, yes. I like that quote.
So it's kind of funny. It's so I always think a lot about, I guess you can say, studio ghosts to a certain degree.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I kind of do the opposite, though, interestingly.
Oh.
Which is that I sometimes, this is going to sound pretty wacky, but I am pretty wacky, so.
Oh, no, please, wacky out.
I will do kind of a meditation before I go into a work in a painting, and I will invite whatever other artists from history want to show up to help me.
Huh.
And then after I paint, I will kind of go back and see what they might want to say to me.
Hmm.
So I feel it's sort of, it's just a kind of a way to honor the whole trajectory of artists, you know, since time beginning, and feel like I'm a part of that field.
Huh. That's interesting. I actually do something somewhat similar also. But where, this is where music comes into play.
Hmm.
Where, because I guess I mean, creatively, I was more occupied with making music when I was younger. I was always painting and drawing, but when I listen to certain songs or albums, they kind of bring me back to in some ways, it conjures up people I knew when that album came out.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Albums bring back time periods, don't they?
Yeah. So it's, so I always feel like it would make me want to listen to an album more so, or stay away from an album, depending what.
Yeah, it's also like, no, I'm not going there.
Yeah, I don't need to see you today, so.
Yeah.
But that's something that I've actually noticed, and I kind of, I guess you can say, try to profit from in my work.
Mm-hmm.
Where I kind of try to conjure up something where it's like, how would I feel when I have this person beside me when I'm making this painting or so. I'm not so sure if that's, but you're actually quite special. You have the big guns, the people from art history.
Well, I mean, it could be anybody. It could be from somebody from now, or sometimes people that aren't artists show up, you know. I kind of created a sense of having a boardroom. So there's like this big round table and a lot of books and stained glass, and it's kind of like, you know, somewhere. I don't know. And you just never know who's going to show up. Of course, now I can't really see anybody because I don't have any internal imagery available to myself, but somehow I know who's there and what's happening.
Is this something that you, well, how did you figure out this is something you do? I know for myself, I figured out this is what I do because I've had a lot of studio mates in the past, and they've always told me that, you know, you mumble to yourself all the time when you're painting.
Well, I learned it. I went to a workshop on shamanic journeying.
Oh.
It's very specific, you know, what you do. You know, you go to a lower world or an upper world. You know, you go find your power animal, or you go find your spiritual, you know, mentors. So I just sort of took those metaphors and sort of translated it to, if I were to do that in terms of an art world, what would that be, you know?
That's interesting.
Yeah, so it's sort of like I have this ever shifting, ever changing board of directors, and I never know who might show up, but there's Catherine Bradford, or there's Goya, or there's whoever, you know.
I was just going to say that I think the only artist that I might conjure up is actually Goya.
Well, he's a good one.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I mean, for me, I don't consider, yes, he's a great painter, but for me, he kind of transcends painting.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's, I sometimes think, you know, that Prince, The Sleep of Reason produces monsters.
Say that again?
The Sleep of Reason produces monsters.
Oh, yeah.
With the head over the desk with all the owls and creatures coming out.
Yes.
For some reason, I still think every painting I do is a version of that, perhaps. Except when I paint food, or maybe also that, I don't know.
Yeah, he was painting about really profound things, really important things.
Well, it's kind of, I don't know. It's a silly thing to say I relate to it, because of course I have not experienced war. I guess maybe I, better way to say is I have some empathy for it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, I think the way he paints humanity does kind of automatically kind of create a sense of empathy in the viewer. Maybe, I don't know, I can't really articulate that much further, but it just feels to me like that's part of the experience.
I think you nailed it. He really depicted humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite, I mean, I think for him, it's Well, his work is just so strange.
Yes, but it's, you know, I think of work in two ways, really. I mean, this is binary, but I think about work that, you know, I see and I'm very impressed by, and it's like awe-inspiring, kind of like, wow. But I don't feel like I can enter that work. I feel like I'm outside of it, looking at something that's out there that's just beyond comprehension in some way, or beyond my impossibility of my kind of having that kind of skill, perhaps. But then there's painters like Goya that are also, their work is awesome, but I feel like I'm a part of it already. I feel like I'm in it in some way. I feel like I can enter it in a kind of a, not a spatial way, but in an emotional way.
Right.
Even in the way it's painted, there's something that draws me into it. Maybe because it's, you know, painted by a human painting humans.
Right.
Like I saw Julie, I can never say her name, is Ruto's work at the Whitney today.
Oh, okay.
It just opened. I just happened to get a free pass with someone else to see it. And it's just incredibly impressive work. It's just, I mean, just labor intensive and just, you know, mind altering because there's so many densities and layers and such detail and massive size. I love it, but I don't feel like I can enter it. You know, I feel like it's almost like it's that scene in 2001 where that alien tablet comes up or whatever, you know, it's like, what is that? You know, whoa.
Right.
You know. And I have a great admiration for it, but it's not something. And then we went downstairs to see the Salman Tour show.
Oh, I saw that show too.
And it was like, oh, this is intimate to me. I can enter this intimacy and I can have great resonance with it. And no, it's not worse. No one's worse than the other. I mean, they both have their tremendous contributions, but very different experience for me personally.
Right. Yeah,
and I know my work gets toward the Salma Tour work instead of, you know, obviously.
Well, I think it's always, I guess this is also a bit of a rhetorical thought of mine is, how much does a painting or any piece of art, how much is it really just a mirror to the viewer itself?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, someone else might feel like, wow, my energy and Julie Metra's energy is like really on the same kind of massive and, you know, dynamic scale. And that may be a perfect fit for somebody else.
Yeah, it's, yeah, no, there's lots of like musings I have about how, and sometimes I like to think about these things and sometimes I don't want to think about these things about how people perceive my work.
Right.
It goes back to the whole ego thing.
Right. Well, it does feel nice when someone does make a connection with your work and it has some impact on them, I think. That is one of the things I do feel good about. You know, not so much people talking to me at openings, but just like if somebody writes me that, like this guy wrote me some narrative about when he saw one of my works on Instagram, he sort of like this whole kind of almost like a dream. He just like wrote out this whole dream sequence that he kind of got from the piece where it took him. And oh, I thought, that's what I like hearing.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
not what I intended, who cares, but it's something that he really, you know, resonated with in his own individual way. And I really appreciate that when that happens.
Yeah, that's really cool. It's,
I guess, to take the time to tell me about it is generous.
To circle back and close the loop on the idea of the catharsis in the work. I think it's, this is something that I was told before. It's, and I still think I believe in that, like I said before, it's kind of, it's very Sisyphean, the idea of catharsis and work. It's not that you get any type of redemption from it. It's just the act of trying for it.
Exactly. It's the act of looking for it.
Right.
Yeah.
But with that said, someone once told me, especially when I was always making art and not showing it to anyone, that there is no possibility for catharsis if it's not shown to anyone.
Right. I like that idea because I think, you know, that there is a collaborative aspect to having other people see the work and have their own individualistic response to it.
Right.
Another part of the collaborating, like I'm collaborating with my board of directors, right? Mm. But then also the work is collaborating with the viewer. And through me, then I'm collaborating with the viewer.
Yeah. And with that way of looking at it, you can say the person who responded to you on Instagram that maybe it's not full catharsis, but it's one kind of like a step in it by his reaction and his participation in it.
Yes. Yes. Well, also, I mean, probably the things that I would be working out in my work have to do with going through things in a very in my life where at a time where I felt pretty isolated, right? So if there's a way that a viewer participates in something that I'm presenting, kind of cuts through that isolation.
Yeah, that's something that I try to appreciate. I have to be honest, not all the time. I love hearing compliments about my work that's at least like 5 years old.
Yeah.
I get too self-conscious about feedback from work that's too fresh.
Yeah, for me, it's not even the compliment as much as that there's some kind of connection to the work.
Right.
You know, it's not that it's well painted or it's something a little less tangible, but there's some kind of click for this viewer. Like it they recognize themselves in it or they recognize something in it that is important to them.
I think you kind of nailed it there also by saying it's a click. It's for me, it's almost, I mean, of course, this is not a rule, but it feels a little black and white when people get it or they don't get it. Either clicks or it does not click.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is the time. This is the lightning rounds of the interview.
Oh, dear. I'm terrible at that, but go ahead.
Well, the lightning rounds is where I get to ask you some like a questionnaire about movies.
Yeah, which I don't watch very many of, but I'll try.
Actually, it might make it more easier. It's just something that I think it's a good exercise to try to get out of the craft of what we do.
Sure.
And I guess, I could go on about why I think it's a good idea. It's also kind of fun.
And it's cool.
Is there a movie that you really like a lot that no one would guess that you like a lot?
I was thinking about this movie a few days ago, American Beauty.
Okay.
Particularly the last scene.
Oh, is that where his body is kind of leaving his body, seeing the reflection in the blood? Is that the second to last scene?
I think the very last scene is he's talking, and I think the image is the plastic bag,
right,
animated in the air, and he's talking about his life from this very kind of expansive perspective. And it reminds me of a scene in War and Peace where one of the main characters is almost dead on the battlefield and he starts to merge with the sky and his whole expansive perspective comes into play. So but I think people wouldn't associate me with liking that movie because there's violence in it. And I tend to avoid violence in movies. Like I don't, I, I'm just, it, you know, keeps me up at night.
Okay. Well, I guess that leads me to my second question. You mentioned War and Peace. Is there, do you have a favorite movie that's based off of a book?
Movie that's based off a book.
Or anything that's written. It could be a short story or a myth or...
Well, I'd have to say that, and this is boringly dating me, but I read every single Wizard of Oz book when I was growing up.
Okay.
20 of them. So I would have to say The Wizard of Oz was something I keep going back to and, you know, keep looking for deeper meaning. And I've gotten stoned and watched it and drunk and watched it and tripped and watched it and tried to find more. Because, it, you know, it was such an important part of my childhood.
Huh. Well, you've given me an idea of the type of movie questions to ask the next person to interview.
Good.
Okay. Well, I guess my last question might be a little redundant or not. Is there a movie that you think represents a very good allegory that clicks with you?
Well, this is also very trite in a way, but I would say Groundhog Day.
Oh.
Huh. Because, you know, the same old thing is happening every day, every day, every day. But slowly there's a little bit of learning that comes in.
Right.
And a little bit more learning. And it's really kind of a metaphor for me, it's a metaphor for kind of, a, I mean, it's a metaphor for having, you know, well, it's kind of a Buddhist, I mean, it's a touted movie in Buddhist circles. And it's, you know, I think it can kind of represent, you know, many lifetimes. In every lifetime, you try to learn a little more from a different angle and you're just trying to just kind of figure it out and figure it out and figure it out.
Right.
Figure out what's important. What's really important.
Yeah. Well, you know, Bill Murray, he's quite Buddhist himself.
Is he?
Yeah. Have you heard of this movie called The Razor's Edge?
Oh, that's from Somerset Maugham, right?
Yes. I've read the book. I'm a big Somerset Maugham fan, but this is the only movie that Bill Murray, the only real drama he was in, and he produced it.
Wow.
And it's very Buddhist. I don't know if you know the book well, but
I read it in my 20s, so that was a long time ago, but I remember liking that book a lot. And there was an earlier version of a movie.
I never
saw the Bill Murray version.
He's amazing in it. And
I'll have to see that.
I think, I mean, for me, a lot of his movies, his sense of humor, how it's kind of dark but humorous, it makes more sense after seeing this film, which is not a comedy at all, has little tinges of it. But it was kind of his pet project. And I think it was released the same time as Ghostbusters.
Wow, new.
Yeah, and that's why he stopped being in films for many years afterwards, because he was shattered that his dream project, his passion project, was not received pretty much at all.
Wow, is it? You think it's? I could find it.
I think so.
Yeah.
If not, I have a version I can give to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I actually like that film a lot. It's kind of funny because that's I feel like that's the movie I was thinking of when I asked you, is there a movie where there's an allegory in it? Groundhog Day. Well, that's kind of funny how things work out.
Really? Synchronicity.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, it was really nice talking to you, Mary.
You as well. It was fun. Nice freewheeling conversation.
Yeah, I try to keep it somewhat freewheeling. I'm only very controlling about my sound levels in the beginning, besides that.
I appreciate the opportunity. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. No, it was interesting. I actually look forward to listening to it over again. Okay. It was great talking to you, Mary.
You too, Jeffrey.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye. And that was my conversation with Mary DeVicentes. Calling it freewheeling is one way to put it. I definitely had a little bit of rambling in the beginning. I don't know if perhaps maybe I was a little anxious beforehand, or maybe there was just some questions I didn't know how to approach, or the fact that I am not that social as much as I used to be anymore. It could also be the fact that I probably should not drink that much coffee before an interview. Ultimately, though, I think we touched upon some really good things in this interview. It's not always easy to bring about those subjects. But that's what I like to do. I like to examine things as frankly and honestly as possible. Music today was brought to you by Michael J. Vitale. You can check out some more of his music on michaeljvitaleband.com. For everyone out there, I hope everyone is keeping things strange.